ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
In a winter that seems especially long, with round after round of snow, cold temperatures, icy sidewalks, even a polar vortex thrown into the mix, most of us are asking by this time whether spring will ever arrive. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to think warm thoughts about the weather as we spend some time with one of the world's leading authorities on climate studies. Mark Schwartz is a distinguished professor in UWM's Department of Geography. Recently, Mark was named a fellow in the American Association of Geographers, and he's also received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the group. Today, we're going to talk about Mark's work in creating a tool that can predict when spring arrives, along with research that he's been doing on how plants and trees may contribute to weather patterns. Welcome, Mark. It's good to have you with us today.
Yeah, it's always nice to be here and have a chance to talk about things like this, particularly, as you say, when we're in this time of the year. Those of us that have grown up in the Midwest know that thoughts of spring are one of the things that sustain us through these difficult times of the year.
You know, it's been a long winter when you bump into a friend on the street or talk to them on the phone, and one of their first questions is, have you been able to get away? Preferably someplace warm. For many of us, that's not the case. But we're hopeful. Spring is coming. In fact, it's around the corner. And much of your work over your career has been looking at finding out when that spring is coming. And is it coming earlier or later, year after year? It's called phenology, right?
Correct. And part of the work, I guess, that we've been doing, of course, is to get people to not think of, say, March 21st as having anything to do with spring. But as most people realize, particularly around this part of the world, that spring doesn't really happen until the plants start to grow. So this idea of using phenology and thinking of that as our definition of spring is something that comes quite natural to people. And so that's one of the things in my connection with changes from climate or whatever that I'm grateful for, is it's pretty easy to talk to people about this, and they readily kind of understand more than, say, if you just say, oh, there's so such and so temperature degree difference, they're not quite sure what that means. But if you say, well, the plants are starting to grow 3 to 5 days earlier now than they were, say, 30 or 40 years ago, they can relate to that. And then I say, well, you can go out and measure it yourself. This is something that's simple. You don't need any particular instruments to do this. You can observe yourself and report. That's what our network of involving individuals of the public has been about.
And I want to talk more about that core of citizen scientists that you've helped build around the country. But let's define phenology a little bit more for our listeners. You literally are studying certain plant groups as you try to make these measurements of when spring comes in comparison to other springs, right?
Yeah, it's basically phenology is a rather ill-defined term in some ways. It technically says the study of things that show or appear. And so people have used all kinds of things, even non-biological events like ice flow. People started to say ice phenology. But for me, the traditional thing of this is it's life cycle events in plants and animals. I don't do any work in animals, but everyone can think about how the return of birds or when certain kinds of mammals come out of hibernation, like that groundhog. We may talk about competition with him later, and that kind of change. But this then is what we're doing, and it's mostly weather events in the short term and climate over the long term then that is regulating this cycle, the start in the spring and the ending in the fall. So things like first leaf or first bloom in plants, the arrival of birds in the springtime, departure of birds in the fall, and coloring and loss of leaves on the trees in autumn. So those are examples of phenological events.
And it's important to know what those trends are, because it does speak to the greater climate, the greater weather that that surrounds us all. Correct?
Yeah, it's been a nice additional measure when we talk about, say, measuring things like climate change. For a scientist, it's very useful to have multiple ways to measure things. So we have our thermometers example that we can look at for temperatures. We then have satellite data that we can look at where we can observe these changes of, say, the vegetation on the surface. But then we can also actually measure the vegetation changes visually or with other instruments ourselves on the ground. And we call those independent measures because the one isn't relying on the other. And so if you have different independent ways of measuring things, it gives you a much stronger understanding and an argument for the any changes that you see being actual change and not just something that is maybe random or coming up by chance.
Are there certain types of plants that lend themselves better to marking the beginning of spring?
Well, in this case, a lot of things that happen in spring are driven primarily by temperature. So the particular plants that we've been looking at are those that their phenology tends to be, say, mostly triggered by temperature and not by light levels, for example. So the understory shrubs that we have ended up using in this study, really as a legacy from agricultural meteorologists who started this work using lilacs and honeysuckles, were an example of a plant that pretty much is very responsive to temperatures. And then some of the other things that were useful in the work is that they were using plants that were clones, so it was the same genetic individuals, because natural plants are different from one place to another. They vary in relationship to their location, and so their phenology varies because of their genetics. So we wanted to control for the genetics, so that was another thing that we did. And now that we have that, we can then, in effect, account for the variations in the local plants by having something to compare them to. So there's a lot of nuances to this, but it's really the idea that anyone can pick a particular plant, but the ones that we're most interesting in and the ones that are most useful to us are ones that are distributed over a fairly wide range so that we can look at them. Unfortunately, unlike weather instruments, there isn't a standard plant that you can plant everywhere, say in a nation as large as the United States. It'd be nice if you could do that, but we have to use like these models that I've developed or other things to try to give us that standardization.
Well, let's talk about the way in which our listeners might get involved in this. There actually is a way for you to peek out your window and see that lilac bush that comes to life, it seems, every spring. You actually can begin recording that data and putting it to good use to scientists like you.
Right. It's a pretty simple website. The USA National Phenology Network is usanpn.org. And if you go there, you'll see that there is a link to Nature's Notebook, which is our name of the observation system. And if you go to that site, then you can register yourself as being interested in observing. Then you can register sites that you want to do the observations. And then you can register plants. And there's all kinds of things to help you select the plants from your local area. We have protocols for literally hundreds, almost 1,000 different plants. There are certain ones that we guide people to that might be the most useful. And then there's animal observations as well, which are a somewhat different protocol. But all of that is available through the web, and people that are interested then not only can see the observations that they've made and compare them, say, if they do it for multiple years, which is the most useful, but they can also look at what others have done. And one of the really exciting things that's not directly connected with the USA National Phenology Network, but is another group called the PhenoCam Network, there are actually cameras that have been placed in a number of locations around the country. So if people go to Google PhenoCam and look at that, they can look at hundreds of sites around the country that are recording data, pretty much half-hourly data throughout the year, and you can actually could go and find, say, where the leaves are turning color or other things like that, or where what the state of the trees are in different places. So there is there's some really neat things for people that are interested in kind of tracking this and recording it on their own, but also just being in touch with what's going on. So it's very interesting and exciting.
And so how would scientists like you and your colleagues then use that data that's coming in from these points all over the country from these citizen scientists? How do you actually use that then in your work?
Well, most of this is a matter of trying to either develop models, for example, because as much as data as we get from the plants, we never have plants in all the places or in all the times that we'd like to. So my basic work was essentially taking the data that we had that extended over a period from the early 60s to the mid-90s when I first developed the model, over pretty much the entire eastern part of the United States. And that gave us a broad range of places to look at the response. And I developed a model then that would work there. And then I tested it against lilacs in other parts of the country and eventually other parts of the world to determine that it was doing a pretty good job. And then I started saying, oh, let's see how it compares to native trees and other kinds of things. So that's the one way. The other example then is to take this kind of data or models and then compare them to things like this, to say satellite data or to these PhenoCam measurements, because that's another way. We affect say that we never get all the measurements that we would like from one source, so we have to have multiple sources. The satellite sees everything, but of course there's clouds that get in the way and there's spatial resolution because it's looking at a whole maybe 500-meter area and just seeing that as one number. And so I sometimes tease my colleagues to say it's difficult to understand what's going on in the forest if you can't see the trees. And so it's sort of like in a lot of the remote sensing, you're not seeing trees, you're seeing a combined response. So, for example, in our own Downer Woods, we have two major species of trees, white ash and also the basswood tree.
This is the Downer Woods on the UWM campus.
Correct. And I say that when the satellite looks at that, it sees a combined response of those two trees, and the tree's phenology is a bit different. So that's one of the things that helps us to disentangle that, because what the satellite sees is essentially a synthetic composite that isn't the response of one species. And so in order to understand that, we need to know how the two species' responses are somewhat different.
So you've got all this data. You can look, use it to look backwards to see the trends on whether spring is coming earlier or not. And I believe it's safe to say spring is coming earlier.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I looked at it around across the lower 48, essentially I've now come to the conclusion that it's not what we would call a linear trend. It's more like if you take a look at from the time period from around the beginning of the 1900s to around the 70s, the trend is relatively flat, and then it, in effect, takes a step down. It becomes earlier by 3 or 4 days, and then it's been relatively stable since then. So this is the other thing, of course, is that it's common misunderstanding, I think, when people think about climate change. They think, well, you know, every year is going to be a little bit different than the year before it. And obviously that isn't really the way that it happens. And these kind of shifts, I think, are one of the things that make the whole prospect of the future change quite challenging, because in effect it could be it isn't going to change all that much. And then suddenly in a very short period of time, it may change a lot. And you don't really know whether that's happening until afterwards, after a few years of happened, and you can compare it to the longer-term trend.
Which is why it's so important to be doing these studies on an ongoing basis.
Correct.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Mark Schwartz. Mark is a member of the UWM faculty, distinguished professor in the Department of Geography, and recently named a fellow of the American Association of Geographers. Quite an honor. And we're so thrilled that he's on the program today to talk about his work that involves the study of the climate in the world that we live in. Mark, you've been talking about the work that you've done around phenology. There's another fascinating project that you're about to get involved in that is going to be taking a look at the impact that trees and plants have on forming or shaping weather patterns, which I find fascinating. Tell us about that.
Well, this is really not anything that is really new information, but what we know is that when plants, say during the wintertime, are dormant, they're effectively all buttoned up, so to speak, and not anything's happening. And then when they become active, when their leaves come out, say if we're talking about deciduous trees as an example, those trees are essentially water pumps. And so once their whole life process is about taking water out of the ground and putting it out through the pores in their leaves, and what that does is it changes the nature of the lower atmosphere. Essentially, there's more moisture in the air. I always have this kind of a jokingly call it a trick question to my students. I'll say, which is lighter, moist air or dry air? And of course, you always think, well, if you add something, it's going to make it heavier. But in this case, water vapor is a lighter gas than oxygen and nitrogen. So if you add water vapor to the air, you actually make it lighter. So think about what this means, that most of our severe weather activity and other kinds of things, for example, are related to how easy it is to lift the air. So when you start to put more moisture in the air, you create the situation where it could be easier to lift. So that's one of the manifestations of that. It also has impacts on, say, what kind of variations there might be in temperature, how low the temperatures get, because the moisture, when you have more moisture in the air, the change of temperature over time is different because of the physics of how energy is lost or gained. So those are the kinds of things. And so we've done a considerable amount of work in the springtime, and this particular project is designed to help us better understand what's going on in the autumn. Autumn is a much more problematic transition. In the springtime, we can say that it's primarily driven by temperature variation, and most of the plants are cued in on that. Autumn is much more nuanced. There's temperature factor, there's a light level factor, and there's also the impact of excess or usually lack of moisture. And various plants respond to those cues in different ways. So what this study is trying to do is measure all of those changes in a controlled area. It's about a 10 by 10 kilometer area where we've already been doing work in northern Wisconsin, and my colleague at the Ankur Desai at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is the lead researcher on this, and my role is to help study the phenology of the trees, then to use my expertise to design and measure those, also to get some satellite data, but to look at the vegetation component. But we're going to be using a lot of instrument towers to measure the exchange of heat and moisture and the actual carbon exchange with the ground, and get all kinds of imagery to help us measure the variations. And so the idea is just to measure the heck out of everything and try to get this very detailed set of information to help us really understand all the exchanges that are going on between the atmosphere and the land surface during this time when the land surface and the plants, I mean specifically, are what we call senescing, where they're closing down
getting ready for the
year
long winter
and getting ready to go into their winter hibernation.
So do you have any hypothesis or any hunch about what you're likely to find in this study yet?
Well, I think one of the things that we're likely to be able to help understand a little bit better is what the different roles of the different kinds of land cover are. For example, the forested areas versus, say, grassy areas versus water areas or whatever, and how much variation there is really perhaps between the different tree species. What's the contribution of the coniferous trees, the deciduous trees? Because the way that these flux studies have typically been done is we have the one site there that is just measuring this for, say, a very large area, and there's just the one measurement. So we're seeing the combination of all of this put together, and now we're going to be able to look at the complexity of how it's slightly different in the different places. And so we'll just like kind of like when I was talking about the satellite, just seeing one pixel, now we're going to be able to get inside the pixel and actually start to look at details that we couldn't see before of the variation.
So as we think about climate change and the fact that our planet is warming, a study like this, would it perhaps lead you and other scientists to understand what type of tree or what type of plant might be best to put in the ground going forward that might help mitigate some of the changes that are occurring around us?
Possibly. I think more likely what this is going to do is I think it, as some of the press about this has already talked about, is that one of the things I'm quite interested in is using this information on effect even in the springtime, knowing when the green-up is happening, to potentially help slightly improve weather forecasts during that time because of the impact on temperatures. So it's essentially knowing a little bit more about the details of what's happening. So another study that I'm actually in the preliminary stages of talking about with some colleagues, including Paul Rober on our campus, an expert in forecasting, is potentially looking at what role the green wave may play in the errors in temperature forecasts, say when it's passing through, and whether that might potentially have a role in incrementally improving the forecast a little bit. So,
a lot of the work that you and your colleagues are doing, I suspect, would never be possible without the construction and evolution of these amazing computers that can process all this data. You're collecting a lot of information.
Yeah, that project up there, there's a whole group that is involved with the process and collection and sorting of the data. Unfortunately, I can defer to them, and most of my data is just a teeny part of that. These measurements of the satellite data and the flux are very large. But I've oftentimes thought that the work that I do, in the course of a year is the work of several lifetimes of people in the past, just because of the ability to process the data, and that's a really a big advantage of what we're doing.
You're using data that is coming to you in such huge volumes, and you're able to manage it in a such more sophisticated manner than the way people did 100 years ago. Does it still help to have those records from 100 years back, knowing that that data was pulled together with rather crude instruments in comparison to what we use today?
Well, that's one of the really kind of interesting things. I could probably talk about this a long time, but that's the neat thing about, say, phenological data. When we have been able to find phenological records in the past at particular locations, they can really help us because if we know when the plants were leafing and blooming, and then we can compare that to today, in effect, that's giving us a connection to that in a way that, say, even an individual temperature record or whatever may not. So that's
because a thermometer might have been off a bit 100 years ago.
I think that's the thing that's interesting, is that people may have the sense of thinking, oh, well, why would you want to look at the plants when you've got all these detailed weather instruments or whatever? But in many ways, the plants are integrating a whole bunch of things, so they're giving you a more representative look at what's going on, perhaps, particularly if you have an array of plants. So it's been particularly useful when there have been studies that have been looking at an array of different species. There's been some interesting work done in the Northeast where they've looked at records taken, say, by Thoreau and others back, or Jefferson hundreds of years ago at Monticello. And then you can look at today and look at some of those same species, and it becomes pretty clear how much change is taking place. And it puts it across in a way that would be difficult to express as clearly, say, with temperature records, because you can say, oh, well, here's this species of trees, and well, you know, 200 years ago, there were several weeks difference in when they were observing them starting to leaf, for example.
And if somebody sitting at home listening to this says, well, what's the difference if it comes 3 or 4 or 5 days earlier? Isn't that a good thing that it's warmer? I suspect they're not thinking about the complex connection between the evolution of these plants greening of these plants and the impact on those birds or the other animals that depend upon the plants, right? You could really screw things up bad if things start greening up too early.
Well, there's several different ways to think of this. The one is what you're talking about, that if the plants start to leaf earlier and say there are caterpillars that are hatching out to eat those and the birds are arriving and expecting the caterpillars to be ready to feed to their chicks at a particular time, and suddenly this whole thing changes. Some birds might be able to adapt if they're coming from a more local area, but the long-term migrants are still going to come at the same time. The other thing that we talk about is, particularly in the West, with all the interest in wildfires and all of that, you start the season earlier and you start pulling moisture out of the soil earlier. So what that means is that you're drier in the summertime, regardless of how much moisture is there. So the beginning of the greening season and the ending of the season have an impact on total soil moisture in the middle of the year, and then that relates to the flammability of the vegetation and things of that sort that can contribute then not to the actual start of the fires, but if a fire is started, then how dry the timber is going to have an impact.
And if nothing else, it gives people a signal that they should brace themselves because it might be a very dry season if everything started to come alive and start sucking that water out of the ground sooner than before.
Yeah, well, and it's particularly noted in places like the West where water is always limited.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mark, it's a pleasure talking to you. I always learn so much when we have you on, and we congratulate you on your award, becoming a member, a fellow of the American Association of Geographers, along with that Lifetime Achievement Award. Great to have you on the staff at UWM, and we wish you great success for many, many more years of conducting great research that helps us understand the world that we live in better.
Okay, thanks. And if we got just a quick minute, I was going to say in my forecast,
we do,
with my colleagues from Cornell that put out the forecast, at this point we're still expecting spring to come a little bit earlier than usual for Wisconsin. So that if that's going to happen, we're going to have a lot of warming in the last part of this month. So we'll see if that pans out.
Fantastic. We'll hold you to that, okay?
Yeah.
I'm hoping you are right.
Yeah, so do I.
Thanks so much. Mark Schwartz, distinguished professor at UWM, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.